Genesis chapter 47. And I'm going to read a lengthy passage of Scripture, and then we'll come back and deal with it. But Genesis chapter 47, we are at verse 13, going through the life of Joseph on these Wednesday nights. So Genesis 47 and verse 13. There was no bread in all the land, for the famine was very sore, so that the land of Egypt and all the land of Canaan fainted by reason of the famine. And Joseph gathered up all the money that was found in the land of Egypt and in the land of Canaan for the corn which they bought. And Joseph brought the money into Pharaoh's house. And when money failed in the land of Egypt and in the land of Canaan, all the Egyptians came unto Joseph and said, "Give us bread. For why should we die in thy presence? For the money faileth." And Joseph said, "Give your cattle, and I will give you for your cattle if money fail." And they brought their cattle unto Joseph. And Joseph gave them bread in exchange for horses, and for the flocks, and for the cattle of the herds, and for the asses. And he fed them with bread for all their cattle for that year. When that year was ended, they came unto him the second year and said unto him, "We will not hide it from my lord how that our money is spent. My lord also hath our herds of cattle. There is not aught left in the sight of my lord but our bodies and our lands. Wherefore shall we die before thine eyes, both we and our land? Buy us and our land for bread, and we and our land will be servants unto Pharaoh. And give us seed that we may live and not die, that the land be not desolate." And Joseph bought all the land of Egypt for Pharaoh. For the Egyptians sold every man his field, because the famine prevailed over them. So the land became Pharaoh's. And as for the people, he removed them to cities from one end of the borders of Egypt, even to the other end thereof. Only the land of the priests brought he not. For the priests had a portion assigned them of Pharaoh, and did eat their portion which Pharaoh gave them, wherefore they sold not their lands. Then Joseph said unto the people, "Behold, I have bought you this day in your land for Pharaoh. Lo, here is seed for you, and ye shall sow the land. And it shall come to pass in the increase that ye shall give the fifth part unto Pharaoh," that's 20%, "and four parts shall be your own, for seed of the field and for your food, and for them of your households, and for food for your little ones." And they said, "Thou hast saved our lives. Let us find grace in the sight of my lord, and we will be Pharaoh's servants." And Joseph made it a law over the land of Egypt unto this day, that Pharaoh should have the fifth part, except the land of the priests only, which became not Pharaoh's. And Israel dwelt in the land of Egypt in the country of Goshen. They had possessions therein and grew and multiplied exceedingly. And Jacob lived in the land of Egypt 17 years. So the whole age of Jacob was 147 years. The time drew nigh that Israel must die. And he called his son Joseph and said unto him, "If now I have found grace in thy sight, put, I pray thee, thy hand under my thigh, and deal kindly and truly with me. Bury me not, I pray thee, in Egypt. But I will lie with my fathers, and thou shalt carry me out of Egypt, and bury me in their burying place." And he said, "I will do as thou hast said." And he said, "Swear unto me." And he swore unto him. And Israel bowed himself upon the bed's head. When we left the story of Joseph last time, the story had almost come full circle. Reconciliation had been made, and Joseph's brothers had gone back to Hebron to convince their father Jacob to move to Goshen in order for Joseph to take care of them. They had made that journey. They have settled down in Goshen, in Egypt, but away from the cultural cities, the influences of that pagan land. And now the families are going to settle in, and they're going to make this the home for the next 430 years. We know from the book of Exodus that another Pharaoh will rise up that knows not Joseph, and he will not treat the Hebrews as kindly as this Pharaoh has done. That we've become a nation of slaves in this land, but even that is known of God and is part of His providence. And what the rest of this chapter deals with, the verses that I read to you are, is the severity of that famine in Egypt. And how that the Egyptians dealt with Joseph for their survival. There were several more years of this 7-year famine, and Joseph seems to take a back seat to this historical side note of what went on with the Egyptians and Joseph in this land back and forth. The Egyptians, they come to Joseph for bread, and he doesn't just give it to them. He buys all of their livestock, all of their cattle, in exchange he gives them grain, and then these people sell their land for bread, and they become tenant farmers, so to say, to Pharaoh in order to feed their families. Then at the very end of the chapter, a very brief comment that we read on the family of Jacob in the midst of that famine. Now this week, as I studied this passage in between laying floor, I looked at it and I thought, you know, there's really not a lot here. Because it's just a historical side note. It really doesn't have anything to do with Joseph or with Jacob. And it's just kind of like an interruption. But as I read it, there was something that struck me. And I believe there is a message in this passage. And it's really timely that we are here tonight with so many people sick and what's going on, that we come to this passage. Because the emphasis of the passage is on how the famine affected the Egyptians. But it does not seem to have affected the Hebrews in the same way. Now the Hebrews did not escape the famine. The famine hit Goshen just like everywhere else. So they experienced the same famine, but they don't resort to the same survival tactics as the Egyptians did. In fact, the story tells us that the Hebrews in verse number 27 actually grew. They flourished. They multiplied in the famine. And there's such a stark contrast between the Egyptians that are selling their possessions and they're selling themselves into servitude just to be able to eat. And then one verse that tells you how great the Hebrews had it in the famine. And I thought, that's what a sharp contrast. Now you have to be careful. That doesn't bring you to a health, wealth mindset. The health, wealth mindset is that if you will serve God, God will make you wealthy. That you'll never be sick. That you will be richer than your neighbor. That's not true. There are some people who think that prosperity and spirituality go hand in hand. That they are mutual. That they are inseparable. And then there are other people who believe that prosperity is a sign that you're not spiritual. Neither one of those is true. I know a lot of poor Christian folks. And your neighbor that drinks and carouses and cusses and smokes dope, he may be doing better than you in terms of money and possessions. So material wealth and spirituality don't necessarily go hand in hand. But here's what happened. God takes care of His children, and He can prosper you. He can multiply you. He can flourish you even in a famine. I really believe that the troubles of this world should not affect us in the same way that it affects the world. That while the world is in turmoil, the Christian ought to be at peace. And while your neighbor has to be on tranquilizers and have a psychiatrist on speed dial, you ought to have a song in your heart and Jesus on your mind, even in the famine. I would tell you that when the famine comes, whatever the famine is, that it is coming to us all.
Yeah. Yeah.
Bad people get the corona. Good people get the corona.
Yeah.
If Joe Biden ends up being our president, he's going to be all of our president. If we go through an economic recession, it's going to hit your little corner of the world too. We are all going to go through it. But the thing about Christianity is that it does not require ideal circumstances in order to grow. In fact, Christianity grows better in bad conditions than it does in good conditions. A famine of any sort is good soil to grow a strong faith. And it's amazing to me at the end of this chapter that you hear Jacob voicing a very strong faith. And we'll get to that. And it's one of the strongest declarations of faith that you've heard him declare in the past 20 plus years. And that faith is strong in the middle of a famine. So what I find so interesting is that the family of Jacob was not affected by the famine in the same way as the Egyptians. Now, later on in the book of Exodus, when God sends those plagues upon Egypt, you remember those nine plagues? Those plagues are going to hit all the land of Egypt except Goshen. Flies in Egypt, no flies in Goshen. Lice in Egypt, no lice in Goshen. It's going to... Darkness in their land, no darkness in Goshen. So they escape all those plagues, but they don't escape the famine. If all of Egypt has been barren and in a drought, but Goshen is flourishing and man, they're growing crops, I'll tell you what would happen. All those Egyptians would have came down there.
Yeah.
They would have gotten that is what they did. So there's no reason to believe that they escaped the famine. They went through the same famine. They went through the same trouble. But the emphasis when it gets to them is not famine. The emphasis is fruitfulness. I have tried to keep that my focus throughout this year. 2020 will always be the year that we look back on as the year of trials. It'll always be the year where if it could go wrong, it did go wrong. We'll always, one day we'll look back on it and laugh about it. Maybe not today. But one day we'll look back at 2020. Boy, do you remember 2020? And I have tried so hard. I have tried so hard not to get obsessed with an election or I've tried so hard just to put that out of my mind. Because all of these things, it affects me physically and material just like it does you. We all know friends and families and churches who have suffered a whole lot worse than what we have. And we think that 2021 will get us out of it. If we can just make it to January 1, maybe not. You don't know. But I have greatly desired that my mind and my emotions throughout the day not be about the famine, but being surrendered to God and devoted to Christ through it all. If your focus tonight could be on what God is doing, if your focus could be on the blessings and the victories that God has given us, you can go through the same trouble as the rest of the world. And God still multiply you in it. That's the message of the passage. So look at it tonight. Notice in verse 13, there is a severe famine. And verse 13 tells you that the famine is very sore. There's no bread. And the people fainted by reason of the famine. Now that's three descriptors that is meant to emphasize upon your mind the severity of this situation. Now you and I have never experienced any kind of famine. We've never experienced lack of food. I have never had a day in my life that I could not eat if I wanted to. Now, there have been days I didn't have anything I liked. Maybe there was nothing I was in a mood for. But I had food. So I can't put myself here. I've always had plenty of food. So when I read about a famine, it's just a theory to me. I've never experienced that. I don't know what it would be like to watch your family literally starving to death and no bread. And when you have exhausted all of your resources and you are helpless against the onslaught of no rain, no crops, nothing. See, here's what the Egyptians do. They turn to government to save them. Yeah. Now, in this case, it wasn't necessarily bad because Joseph has been placed in charge of preparing the nation for what was coming. They knew that this was going to happen. Back in chapter 41, he has been placed in charge of organizing and administrating
policy whereby the nation would survive and store grain up for 7 years of plenty. And so it's reasonable that in this case that the people would come to Joseph in the middle of the famine for relief, because for 7 years he's been storing up. However, I would tell you that a people who increasingly look to government to bail them out, or a people who are increasingly putting themselves in servitude to that government. Now, I can preach on this for a long time. And I don't believe that this passage is here to give us a pattern of government outreach. And I don't believe that is the purpose for it, all right? But I will say that most Americans are content to just let government take care of you. Most Americans, and you're seeing it right now, most Americans prefer security over liberty. But when you choose security over liberty, you will eventually have neither one. After a few years of the famine, the people in the fields and the cities, they have exhausted all the resources, but the government of Egypt has all this grain stockpiled up. So they come to Joseph and they strike a deal whereby they sell all of their livestock in exchange for grain. Now that may sound like that he's taking advantage of them, taking advantage of poor people, but I actually think he's doing them a favor. Because if they don't do something, they're going to lose the cattle. They're going to lose livestock too. And nobody can sustain the livestock through all these years of drought. So why not exchange them for grain that you can live on? But then another year expires and all that grain is expended. And so they come back. This time, the only thing we have left is our bodies and our land. That's all that we have left. And so this time they strike up a deal to exchange all of our land for grain. So what happens is the government takes ownership of all of the farmland in Egypt. And the arrangement is that the government would own it, the people would work it, and in exchange you would give a fifth part, 20% of whatever you raise back to Pharaoh. Verse 21 says that Joseph moved all of the people into the cities. Now it sounds like, I'm not sure, but it sounds like they sold their lands to Pharaoh. Joseph took responsibility to feed them until the famine was over, and then that they returned to their lands perhaps, and he gave them seed to plant, and that's when the 20% kicked in. I think that may have been how the arrangement was. In the Middle Ages, this would be called a feudal system. Now, this would be the same as sharecroppers in the South and in centuries and decades ago in our own country. And it's not a bad deal if you are content to see most of your earnings go to somebody else. But that's what they did. Verse 21 and 22, little side note. As for the people, he removed them to cities from one end of the borders of Egypt, even to the other end thereof. Only the land of the priests bought he not. For the priests had a portion arranged, assigned them of Pharaoh, and did eat their portion which Pharaoh gave them. Wherefore they sold not their lands. So the Egyptian priests were exempt. Well, why is that? Well, probably because it was a state-controlled religion. It was probably state religion that was the same thing. And government's not going to tax its own church, its own religion. And if that is the case, it sheds light on the corruption and the paganism that the sons of Jacob had to live under. So this is the arrangement. So here's the question. Here's the question, if you can think with me. Was it fair? Was Joseph right? Was Joseph wrong in doing this? They say that power corrupts, absolute power corrupts absolutely. So when you read this, is Joseph being a shrewd, unfair proponent of some form of socialism? Does this sound like extortion to you? Is it right to take advantage of people that are in dire straits? They're trying to survive, so he buys their cattle, he buys their land. Even worse, do you think that Joseph maybe lined his pocket with some kickbacks like you know our politicians would have done? Well, I don't believe that he's being unfair. I don't believe that it is socialism. I don't believe that it's extortion. And I would just run through a couple of reasons. One, it would be contrary to everything that you know about Joseph up to this time. Joseph has a pretty good track record. So all of a sudden, to be this shrewd, unfair
politician doesn't square with the character that we know of Joseph. Secondly, none of the money went to Joseph. He's acting on the behalf of Pharaoh. It all went to Pharaoh, so he's not getting rich off of it. Thirdly, if you read the story again, it is their idea to trade their cattle. It is their idea to trade their land. They came up with the idea. Joseph agreed to it. Fourthly, if you look at it from as a form of taxation, then their taxes amounted to 20%. They exchanged 20% of their production, and the government provides the rest. Most of us would settle for a flat 20% tax. If it includes my property tax and my income tax and sales tax, if it includes everything, I would settle for 20%. So from a taxation standpoint, it's not an unfair or unreasonable deal. Then, in verse number 25, you can read it, the people thanked Joseph for helping them. So they didn't feel taken advantage of. You don't thank a despot or a dictator. No, it is a benevolent relationship. Finally, it's not free market capitalism, but it's not socialism either. And here's the reason why. For one thing, they are not required to sell their livestock or their lands. The government didn't come and confiscate anything. It's not communism. Nor did the people go to the government looking for a handout. They aren't expecting anything free. It's not taking land from a wealthy farmer in order to give money to a poor farmer. It is not wealth distribution. So with the limited knowledge that we have, I judge that Joseph acted fairly and graciously, and he's able to help people in dire straits. It's a severe famine. But here's the contrast in verse 27. You have a settled family. Look at verse 27. And Israel dwelt in the land of Egypt in the country of Goshen. They had possessions therein and grew and multiplied exceedingly. Now, I don't know when Moses wrote this if he meant for it to be a contrast. But after reading what we just read, this whole pitiful situation and government's got to help you. Now to read the prosperity of the Hebrews, I tell you, that is just, it's just such a stark contrast. Because at one end of the country, you have Egyptians that are suffering and they're starving. And you have a family that has settled down in Goshen and they're beginning their new life. And though the famine affected all of the land, the emphasis with them is not on the famine, it's on flourishing. You'll notice in verse number 27, the word Israel. Israel dwelt in the land of Egypt. We know that Jacob's name had been changed to Israel. Israel will also become the name of that great nation that came from him. And I believe that in verse 27 personally, and if you'll notice how it moves from singular to plural, Israel dwelt in the land and they had possessions therein and grew and multiplied exceedingly. I believe it's the first time that the word Israel is used for the nation. And God had promised Abraham 235 years earlier that he would make of him a great nation through which the world would be blessed. But when Abraham died, he had one heir. And so when Isaac died, he had two. And when Jacob died, he's got 70. That's still not a great nation. But the verse is telling us that this family of a father and 12 sons become that mighty nation while Egypt is languishing in a famine. And again, no reason to believe that the famine doesn't hit Goshen as hard as it hits everywhere else, because if Goshen had flourished, then Goshen would have been overran by everybody else that was starving. But the family, if they move in the middle of a famine and they have as many years of barrenness as everybody else does, but the emphasis is not a famine, it's not a famine. They are flourishing in fact, they settled down and they raised their kids and they worshiped God and they served God and they took care of one another and God prospered them. What the modern gospel wants to tell you is that God will keep you out of the famines of life. And if you listen to Kenneth Copeland and TBN and the like, they'll tell you that God's people don't ever get sick. God's people don't have financial struggles. God's people can't command wealth. It is not so. God never exempted you from any of the common troubles of a cursed world. But may the emphasis of your life not be on famine.
May it not be on trouble. May it not be on whatever is going through. No, the emphasis of our life ought to be on the blessings of God in the midst of a famine. The world has plenty of reasons to wring its hands in despair and wonder what tomorrow holds, but not for the believer. Because you and I have the promises of God. We have a God tonight that can take care of us, that can give us peace. We have an inheritance tonight that is incorruptible, that fadeth not away. We have a hope that transcends tomorrow or a virus or an election or a looming recession. I tell you that we sing this without even believing it, but it is true. I don't know about tomorrow, but I know who holds my hand. Interesting statement at the end of verse 27. It says, they grew and multiplied exceedingly. If you were living in that time, you would be tempted to think, if you were a newly married couple, boy, this is not a good world to bring children into. If you're just thinking about starting your family, you might could have some reservations about bringing children into this troubled nation. And if you watch the news enough, you could think maybe we ought to wait. Maybe this is not a good time. Maybe we ought to put this off for a couple of years with all the uncertainty. I don't know if we're going to be able to take care of them. I believe that is bad counsel is what I believe. But the command is to be fruitful and to multiply. And if you wait for the right time, it will never be a right time. They grew numerically in the famine. And if I could apply it to the church, I believe that the church ought to grow and multiply even during this time. This is a time for the church to rise up. This is a time for the church to be aggressive in reaching souls. This is the time for the church to start new ministries and take on more missionaries, even in troublesome times. I believe that. It's so sad to me to hear of other churches that are struggling through everything that's going on in our country. There are some churches in states that have idiot governors and they're being fined and forced to shut down. And gratefully, we've not faced that. And I thank God for that. I will tell you right now that we'll never shut the church down again if government demands it. We make decisions internally as a church, try to keep people safe. But if it gets to where you just have to take care of yourself, I'm going to be here. I'm going to be here. And everybody has to, just like we said at the very beginning, you got to do what you got to do. And I respect that. And we make decisions like canceling these parties, just trying to minimize as much as we can. Most churches right now, they're low in attendance and they're low in morale and they're low in finances and they're low in visitors. I'm going to tell you, the church has always survived the upheavals of society, whether it is a corrupt political system or an economic recession or a health crisis. And the world may be famishing. The church is to be flourishing. Severe famine, settled family. But in these verses, verse 28 through 31, you have strong faith. Jacob always thought that he was dying. This time he's right. He's getting close to it. Once he moves to Goshen, he'll enjoy 17 more years of watching his family grow and spending time with his grandkids. But somewhere as the end draws near, he makes an odd request of Joseph. And the request is, do not bury me in Egypt. When I die, don't bury me here. He's appreciative for the help that they received in Egypt, but Egypt is not home. And when I die, I want you to take my body back to the family cemetery in Machpelah in Canaan. You bury me there. But it is more than a bury me at home request. Because Jacob knew that God had told Abraham that his people would be afflicted in a strange land for 430 years, but God would deliver them out. And Jacob has a long view of things. And he knew that hundreds of years later, his family was leaving. He knew they were going back home. He said, you're not leaving me behind. Don't leave me behind in Egypt. You take me home and you bury me there because God promised to give us that land. And when all of my descendants are living in that land, I want to be there too. You and I know that the blessed hope of the church is for Jesus to come and take us out and take us to heaven. That's our blessed hope. The blessed hope of the Jewish nation was not heaven. The blessed hope of the Jewish nation was for God to give them a kingdom in that land, an earthly kingdom. That was the blessed hope of Jacob. And the statements that he makes shows a strong faith. He believed in those promises just as strongly as he did when he was a young man. He understood there is more to life than what meets the eye. There is a promise to hold on to. And I don't know if Jacob knew anything about the gospel of Jesus Christ. I know in the book of Job that Job believed in the resurrection. So I can't say how far the faith of the patriarch stretched, but Jacob must have believed that a better day is coming. He believed that God's promises to the children of Israel would eventually make them a great nation, and that all the nations of the earth would be blessed through Messiah. It was that faith. It is that faith that he demonstrates in this dying declaration. He knew that his future was as bright as the promises of God. Jacob knew that his death was not the death of God's promises. He believed that God's promises for that land would be fulfilled centuries after he died. He believed that one day, despite all the evidence to the contrary, the world would be a much different place, and he wanted even his burial to be a testimony to his faith in God's promises. Severe famine. Our world's going through it. Every letter I read from missionaries, it's a lockdown. It is the entire world. And go to Walmart. They're scared to death. And in the middle of it, the family of God, just living for God, serving Jesus, at peace. At peace, demonstration of a strong faith. And I pray God to help you. God to help us, help our church, help these other churches to get our eyes on God and His promises and His faithfulness and turn the news off. Turn it off. Get your nose in the book. Sing some great hymns. And let that word refresh you and revive you. And you can get up tomorrow morning with joy in your heart and a song in your mind. And you can go through the day and singing and praising and thanking God for His blessings, even in the midst of a famine. It should not affect you the same way it affects them. Let's stand together tonight, shall we?